It's your host, Steven, and you guys are listening to the Learn Swift podcast. On today's episode, I have Sid Verma. Did I pronounce that right, Sid?
You did. Yeah, very well.
Okay, cool. Cool. Sid is a technical support engineer full-time and is working on his startup project, Twine, and he's been doing that for the last 2.5 years. Sid, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So what have you got going on today? I think we're recording on a Tuesday, April 10th.
Yeah, Tuesday, April. I mean, it's a pretty standard day for me. I've been taking customer cases and just wrapped up my day about, I would say, 20 minutes ago. So,
okay. Where are you at? Are you on the West Coast?
Yeah. So I'm in Santa Cruz.
Okay. Okay, cool. Good to go. Yeah. 7:15, you know, I'm in 7:15. It's actually around 7:30 my time here in Texas. But yeah, now that you say that you ended your day not that long ago, do you live like real close or do you work from home or anything?
Yeah, so the position is actually entirely remote, so I get to work from home from Santa Cruz, so it's kind of amazing.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I get the option to work remote on occasion. It's not something that I can really do all the time because I manage inventory, so if I was to work remote all the time, that would pretty much be impossible. But I do try and take advantage of working from home as much as I can. So you're a technical support engineer. What does that entail? Like, that seems like a very fancy name. What is it that you do?
So it's a fancy name, but basically what I do is customers come in with, you know, I should back up with explaining what the actual product is. It's basically it's an SVN tool, a team sort of building communication tool that this company called CollabNet has produced. And what I do as a technical support engineer is basically people will come in, our customers will come in, and they'll be freaking out about some problem. And it's our responsibility to sort of A, calm them down, and then understand that, you know, their problem can be solved. And we try to flip that ticket around within, I would say, a day or two.
So SVN, is that something like Git? Because I see that a lot in, I would say, what is job postings or whatever, like SVN, Mercurial, Git, something like that. Is that a version control type of system, or is this something different?
Yeah, it's a version control system.
Okay, yeah. So what led you there? And actually, let's go back even further and just kind of start with your background, just in general, how you got to where you are now, what got you into Swift and iOS development. You know, just give us the whole story.
Oh yeah, so I was to provide perspective where I am right now, I'm still in college. So I'm a fourth year at UCSC, a computer science degree full on. So really, I would say going back 3.5 years, I had this huge issue of, wow, everything I'm learning in college, I can't really apply to make the cool stuff that I want to make. So then I thought to myself, all right, like what are the few buzzwords in the community right now? And you know, now it's blockchain and AI. Back then it used to be, I think, cloud, big data, and apps. And those three things were, you know, that stood out to me. I was like, all right, let's start making an app. So, you know, I picked up Swift around 2.5-3 years ago. Hated the programming language at first, didn't understand anything, kind of just really didn't want to do any sort of iOS development within the first week I picked it up. And from there, I was like, maybe I'm just doing boring projects. So then I got hired in air quotes, even though no one can see them, but I got hired onto my first startup, which was basically, I didn't get paid at all. And I worked as an iOS developer for them. And I really got to make the full technology stack that they needed. And I did that over my summer break in school. And I really got to just sort of mess around with this production environment. There was no expectation from my end. There was no product. I was making it. And I got to really get away from those kind of BS time stop or the stopwatch apps and the you know, recipe book apps. And I got to make something that, you know, you're using a full stack of technology. You're writing some notification server. You're sending stuff down to the client. You're doing data modeling, you know, the whole nine. And that's where I was really starting to fall in love with Swift and just, I guess, mobile development as a whole. Yeah.
Okay. What was it that you were making? Can you say?
Yeah.
Did it launch?
I think it launched. I'm not 100% sure, to be honest. I stopped keeping track with the product once I started my own stuff.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So you do this internship or what have you? You said that you're working on it, and what are you doing after that?
So after that, I mean, I'm back into school, but the itch of Swift still hasn't been, you know, sort of satisfied. So I'm still doing a lot of the programming. I'm still doing a lot of the development for them while I'm in school, and I keep on doing that until I basically burn out and want to start my own stuff because now I know enough.
So at what point? So okay. So you said that you're in your fourth year of college.
Yeah.
So how do you feel? Yeah, I'm always curious. I haven't talked about this much on the podcast, but I'm in school too, not for computer science. There's not really actually too many of those that you can do remote, because I absolutely refuse to go take night classes at like the local university or anything. I'm pursuing a software development degree, and I'm just about done with it. I just have to finish one of my last projects. But how do you feel that your computer science courses and stuff has helped you with, say, iOS development? I think there's a lot of things that probably help in the grand scheme of things. But like, do you feel like your curriculum helps you very much, or just holistically helps you?
You know, I would say it holistically definitely helps. In the day-to-day, definitely. I don't think it does very much in the day-to-day, but holistically, if there is a problem that sort of comes up where I'm like, oh, hey, my compiler is not going over this properly, or I'm seeing some issue and it goes back to like the assembly code, then I can go about starting to piece together and debugging that. And now I don't know if that's just the CS degree or if that's just my ability as a computer scientist to do that, and sort of out of intuition understand as to what the issue might be. So I really can't answer that question definitely in any good way. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I understand. Have you, since they're two completely different, do you go over like concurrency issues, like reader writers problems and stuff like that, in CS?
I'm going to be honest that the program differs from everyone. So I expect anyone who's listening right now will probably like, they'll be in two different boats where it's like, oh no, completely not. We don't do that. We just program in Java all the time in school. And then there's going to be the people they go to schools that are more connected to the industry, and they're probably thinking, oh, that's something I see every single day.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually came across a problem that I had where I actually had to use a semaphore. I don't know if you're familiar with that. But it's you can have like in iOS, we have GCD and whatnot. So you can have like a dispatch queue, and it's essentially you've got your, instead of actually spawning off different threads, you can use the global queue, and then you can say it's like a user initiated, user interactive, which would be like the main thread, utility, and then background, I think, are the four queue levels. But you have another thing that you can use, which is a semaphore, which is more or less something that you can use to block something else from running a piece of code. And something has to take ownership of it. Like a certain thread has to take ownership of this part of the logic and say, okay, I've got the semaphore. Nobody else can run this piece of code until I say, hey, I'm done. And then anybody else can grab it and come next in line. So I had an issue where I was using a dispatch queue, and for some reason, the barrier flags weren't working, or maybe even I was implementing it incorrectly. I forget what the issue was, but I ended up using the semaphore. And I remember from school, I was like, oh, I wonder if there's any other way to block anything else from accessing. Because what was happening is whenever the thing that I was working on was multi-threaded, it was changing other parts of it underneath it. So when it was trying to access something or do whatever, it was crashing because it was getting something, you know, a shared mutable state, that, you know, big issue. But I ended up using something that I learned in school. But that was the one thing. That was it.
Yeah, no, I want to really relate to that, but honestly, our thread concurrency and like that stuff, we learn so much more down the line after all of the freshmen have kind of lost their interest in CS. We have all our readout classes, and the people that are left over, you know, we're kind of just waiting to get out of school now at this point. I think that's for most students. Yeah.
Yeah. just my little had to geek out there for a second. So when you first started approaching Swift, so you said that you picked up Swift about 2.5-3 years ago. And that was kind of when the languages, I mean, we're in 2018 now. So that places us back at like 2015. Swift is barely just come out. It probably hasn't even been open sourced yet at this point, has it, when you first picked it up?
You know, back then I didn't even know what the concept of open sourcing was. That's how
okay.
It was. Yeah. For me.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. What kind of resources did you use starting out though back then? Cause I imagine there was a lot of stuff that, I mean, there, I'm sure there was people trying to get on the bandwagon, I wouldn't say bandwagon, but you know, trying to get stuff translated into Swift, but there's probably still a whole lot of Objective-C stuff. What was it like dealing with that at that point?
So, I mean, first was, it was figuring out the question, oh man, should I start with Objective-C or should I start with Swift? Because there's obviously that giant barrier to entry as a second year CS student. I saw C inside Objective-C and I started panicking because, I mean, no one in my age really liked using C whatsoever. Swift had a much catchier name to it, which looking back at it is honestly probably why I chose it. But back then, I just Googled how to make an app. And there was those standard tutorials where it was, oh, how to build a stopwatch or how to, you know, make a very simple recipe app or something. And I thought to myself, wait, there's like Spotify, Facebook, Instagram, they're all on the App Store. Not everyone learned this way. So what am I doing watching these YouTube videos?
Right. So you have some opinions about tutorials in general. What you want to go ahead and share those?
Yeah, I mean, so I'm not going to say tutorials are bad because I can't definitely say that, but I think that they should be viewed definitely as this as a stepping stone and not so much like, oh, this is, you know, I've made an end product of any sorts, because a lot of people the people that I've met, especially that want to become iOS developers, they have this sort of notion that, oh, you know, it can't get harder than this, or, you know, iOS development, it might be easier than traditional, like a software development environment where I'm writing something for, you know, like let's say a website, or I'm writing a piece of backend code. And it was very, I realized very quickly and early on that, you know, iOS development is no joke in itself. You're writing a full-on like networking stack pretty much. You're doing stuff like image caching, and you're optimizing all of your code for this tiny device that is pretty much, I mean, for most of the time, not connected to any power source. And you're boxing yourself in these constraints that you've never seen before as a programmer, if you come from a computer science background. And, you know, if you don't, then it's probably even more challenging because you're writing really optimized code, or you're trying to figure out how to optimize your code as well as you can. And when you have this notion of, oh, I'm making a stopwatch app and that's the end of it, it turns into this, maybe, you know, we're going a mile wide and an inch deep. We're kind of just skimming over like what exactly does a UI or a view hierarchy mean, and what does this mean for our memory allocation, and what things are we doing right and what things are we doing wrong. And what I would like to see in the perfect world of tutorials would be that, you know, you go through this process of, okay, this is a UI view, and then we go that mile deep and we understand properly, like, you know, a UI view does this, it has certain bounds, you can subclass it in this way, and, you know, this is a UI button, and these are the responsibilities of it. Yeah.
I don't disagree with you, but I do think that sometimes, especially like, I would say that it would be cool to have like a Paul Hudson style, like Hacking with Swift, anybody's familiar with him, have that Paul Hudson style overview where it kind of just, you can just get it done, but then say embedded, like, or a little aside, like, this is an oversimplification. You can get more in depth if you want to go down the rabbit hole here. So like, maybe you don't give a crap about view hierarchies at that point in time, but then you get to say, I don't know, URL session, you're like, oh, how do I get the most out of URL session or whatever, and then you can go down that rabbit hole. That would be cool. I think that would be pretty neat, because you can get the best of both worlds, I think, in that way. That would be, I think that would be pretty neat. What do you think about that?
Yeah, no, if that was the, I mean, that would be the best option, I think, if something like that was more widely available, and if YouTube or some platform like that could support that type of learning, then I would totally be down for it.
Yeah, I've definitely shied away from the video tutorials for the most part. When I consume YouTube now, like, and I never really used a whole lot of YouTube tutorials to begin with. When I consume YouTube now, it's more about like the, I guess, like soft skill type of stuff, or maybe even just kind of overall, like, you know, like interview prep type of stuff, not more or less like, oh, I need to code along with you. Like, I've been watching a lot of Sean Allen lately. I feel like I've been getting a lot out of him. He just released a job hunt mega vlog, and he talked about his experiences interviewing with Google, Facebook, Apple, and Coinbase. But that's the kind of stuff I'm watching now, versus like anytime I want to learn something, I usually read it, because I can pick and choose what's really necessary. Because one of the things that I'm really not enjoying these days when it comes to video tutorials, it's like, okay, I can, you know, I get the IB action and I get like how to hook up all this stuff. Let's just kind of get over to the meat of what I want to learn. And it's, I don't know. And then, you know, then you can set it to like 2-speed or whatever. I think it's just a whole lot easier for me now to go to a book.
Right. Yeah. No, I agree. And I think what these the tutorials specifically are creating is this generation of not really software developers, I would say, as a whole, but specifically these sort of, like, you see the buzzwords in the industry. So, I mean, like, let's continue with the iOS 12 example, where it's, you know, you have these developers, the people that want to become developers, and they've Googled what they want to Google and how to do it. But as soon as you deviate from that, and as soon as any other problem comes up, that's where that panic arises. So I don't think that calling someone like that a software developer would really be the proper term. I think all you're doing at that point is just writing code. And if there's one thing I've learned between my like 4 years of CS, my college career, it's that there's a big difference between someone who knows how to write code, someone who knows how to write good code, and someone who understands exactly what that code is doing.
Yeah, you know, I think, and I'm not going to name the quote unquote company that when I first started learning iOS development, I was like all in on this certain company that was putting out tutorials. And I probably spent the first 4 months learning just bad practices, kind of taking everything at what they were saying. And that really, I feel like I would probably be further along now than if I would have just started with like the more generally accepted places to start learning. But I came at this from not having really any experience or any exposure to the iOS community at large. So a lot of the people that, you know, I come across like might not even know of who I was actually following along with. And actually, when I was learning Swift, I was pretty much learning how to write Swift in Java almost, because they were like suggesting to do getters and setters. So like you would make a private variable and then you make a public variable and then write a getter and setter for it, like you would with like the property observer type things that you would do in Swift, instead of making it a public let for just a get only public property that you don't want to mutate, or a private set public var so that you can mutate it in the class but make it immutable outside of the class. You know, nothing like that. I didn't learn any of that probably until like, I don't know, 9-10 months of me learning Swift. Mostly because I started going by these poor practices that I picked up off the bat, and it took me a while to unlearn them.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. That's exactly. I mean, I'm in the same boat as well. I learned from, I'm going to honestly guess, the same place that you did. Again, to not name names, but I'm sure it's the same place. And I picked up on these not so great programming practices, and I found myself somehow in my first iOS development interview, and I was I was learning more in the interview than I had learned probably in all the time that I had learned from becoming that, you know, getting to that point. And it was so concerning to me that everything that I had learned was pretty much either bad practice, it was not the industry standard whatsoever, or it could cause some sort of serious security issue. So.
Yeah. Yeah. As soon it really even took me a while. I almost feel like I had like, I don't want to say Stockholm syndrome because that's being overly dramatic, but, you know, it took me a while to realize that because I was like, oh, but, you know, they still had like, you know, nice designs and stuff like that. But then like just looking back at it is like they put too much on the presentation, but not enough on the execution. And the way they present it is that, like, you know, you're going to be ready to go out into the world and make your own stuff. And I was like, oh, this has got to be the way to do it. And, it, you know, rude awakening, really, because as soon as I tried to make my own products, I was exactly like you were saying before. It just wasn't enough. It just like I didn't get the. I was thinking that, you know, oh, this is just how you do this. So it's got to be this easy as just following along with these guys. And that's a little bit of me being naive, but that's also a little bit of them also saying like, this is the, you know, continuing to sell themselves saying that this is what you need. And this is all you need or whatever. So yeah, I don't know. At the end of the day, it got me exposed. So there's a plus side in that because I haven't looked back since I started.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's, I would love to see this tutorial in a perfect world where it would expose, you know, these new people coming into the iOS development world to not just like, oh, you know, you can make a timer. I mean, as you can probably tell, I really hate timers by this point, but, like there's so much more, there's so many more cool things you can do inside the iOS world. And it seems almost unfair to tell someone that, oh, hey, you're going to invest, let's say, 10 hours into building this thing. But at the end of it, you're going to get something that you already have inside your phone. Yeah.
That you can like look at and be like, wow, that's pretty awesome. I think another issue that I've found when it comes to tutorials, especially like, I don't want to say fly by night blogs, but like. People that are putting stuff out on the internet just to have something out on the internet. And I came across a tutorial and I'm not going to name names here either because what they did was kind of cool, but it was poorly structured. They were using, they were calling functions that they defined in other files that they didn't include in their overarching tutorial that they did on their blog post. And I was just looking up, so I was just trying to look up how to, I was trying to use Vision to do text detection, and I was just trying to get like real quick and dirty, like how, you know, what am I looking at, and then what do I need to do to get the points for where the characters are. I ended up completely going a different route with that project because Vision was actually more than I really needed, so I ended up scrapping it anyway. But when I went through it, I was very surprised at how little effort they really put into it. And then the poor code structure. That's one thing that I really wish I could see more in tutorials. Probably like I get tired of seeing implicitly unwrapped optionals all over the yes. place. Like I know it's a tutorial, but whenever when new people are coming to look at your stuff, and they see these exclamation points, you're mostly reinforcing bad behaviors. There are, you know, instances where a bang operator is okay, like with the IB, with IB outlets and stuff like that. Maybe, you know, even for me, I'll never even use an exclamation point. Even if I want it to fail, I'll explicitly unwrap using a guard, and then if I want it to crash there, I'll have it do a fatal error instead with a more descriptive thing other than you went to unwrap an optional and it was nil. So I just wish that, you know, especially that, because even if optionals are hard to understand when you first come across them, I think that if you just enforce the proper handling of them, like, it'll start to make sense at some point without having to throw exclamation points everywhere. It doesn't take that much more code. It doesn't take you that much more to write to make a safe bit of code.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's so when I started picking up on the database aspect of, you know, this was, I think I was building a very basic social app. It might have been a Twitter clone. I can't exactly remember, but I was building it out on Firebase, and this was before it was bought out by Google. And I was just running up against this wall where every time I build the app, it would keep on crashing over and over again. And it was because I wasn't using optional chaining. I had exclamation points where I needed to have question marks. And that behavior was so reinforced in my mind where if I have something inside a database and I get it back, and I should be able to expectedly unwrap it and everything should be fine. When in reality, I would say that happens less than 1% of the time that you get exactly what you want back from a certain request.
Yeah. There's just a, I don't know. I think I can't think of, like, I don't know that there is such thing as a perfect tutorial. I don't know that there ever will be, because, you know, you're going to have a trade-off, but I do think that's one thing that we can see is just proper treatment of optionals.
Yeah.
Don't bang on them optionals, people. Okay. So do you have anything else that you want to say about tutorials?
No, I think I'm good with bashing on tutorials for now.
Okay. But there's still, you know, one thing that I will say about tutorials, and I still reference them. What I do now, and, you know, everybody else is going to be at a different point in their journey whether they're just starting out or whether they're more advanced. Tutorials are still a good resource to have when you need to figure something out. Maybe like I've gotten a lot better at looking at the Apple documentation for new APIs and stuff like that. But when it comes to like looking at how is somebody implementing this, you know, maybe what is a better way to do it than what I'm trying to do now, there's probably something out there that'll at least get you halfway. And then you can decide like, okay, I see where they're going with this. I'm gonna tweak it and do my own thing with it because I feel it's more modular or something like that. All stuff that I learned the hard way by trying to build apps that ended up being no-goes. I paid for my Apple developer, you know, the $100 fee or whatever. Right. And I actually just got rebuild, and I never shipped any. I still haven't shipped an app yet. I'm getting there, but it's.
Yeah. If I can just add one more point at the end, so I don't seem like a, you know, it's just a complete just basher of tutorials. I would say that, you know, I started from tutorials, and they are 110% completely necessary for people that are starting out. But I think as a beginning developer, we have like this habit of looking at these big pieces of technology like Tinder, Instagram, Facebook, whatever it might be. And we kind of just assume that, oh yeah, I'm definitely not capable of making those things just right off the bat. And early on, I had that assumption too. I was like, the only thing I can really make are timers and recipe book apps. And I am completely comfortable in that entire realm of things. And then, I started building out Twine, the startup I'm working at, and you know, it's a full-fledged social network that has DMs, profiles, images, everything from, you know, image caching to sending a message to notifications to cron jobs running on a JavaScript server. And you know, that's all attainable. So if I could say one thing to someone who's watching a tutorial, just know that it's not the end whatsoever, and there's so much more cool stuff to build out there.
SwiftFest is a new conference about iOS development coming to Boston, Massachusetts, June 18th and 19th, that brings together engineers, architects, midnight coders, and students in a highly social and vibrant environment entirely focused on Swift. Organized and operated entirely by volunteers, SwiftFest is offering workshops along with talks and networking with some of the most innovative developers in the Swift community. Over 2 days, you'll get a chance to hear from the diverse set of speakers covering a wide range of topics. Susan Bennett, the voice of Siri, and Erica Sadoun are just two of the prominent speakers in the SwiftFest lineup that you will not want to miss. And for listeners of the Learn Swift podcast, SwiftFest is offering a 20% discount. Simply go to swiftfest.io and enter the code LearnSwiftPodcast20off. Hyphens in between all of those words, Learn Swift Podcast 20 off at checkout. SwiftFest is also offering a student discount and scholarship program. I'll also put a link to the discount in the show notes and get your tickets for 20% off. I'm going to be there. I'm real excited to go to Boston. This is my first conference. Garrick of Swift Coders is also going to be there emceeing the event. And I hope to see anyone there, come and say hi to me. I'm the guy with the tattoos. So you've got this app, Twine, and it's on the App Store. I took a look at it. I mentioned before the show that I would have downloaded it, but it does have some of those, like, I wouldn't say Tinder-like, but it's definitely somewhere where somebody could meet, like, a romantic partner if they wanted to. And that's not something that I want to explain to my wife. Like, why do you have this on your phone? Like, oh, the guy that I'm interviewing developed it. Uh-huh, sure. But what got you started? And you said you're co-founding it. How did you meet that person? Was it at school?
So the founder, actually, he approached me, and this was back in my, I want to say, second year of school. Yeah, probably. I don't know. The memory's a little bit hazy. And I had made this long Facebook post on my UCSC's Facebook page explaining about how I want to start an entrepreneurial group and all this stuff. I ended up starting the group, but it kind of just fizzled out towards the end. But he, I guess, was really perceptive of that and saw that I had this drive to start my own stuff. And we met for coffee. And he explained this idea to me about how social interactions these days are so driven by expanding our network and not really, I would say, tapping into our existing network and really creating these communities within the people that we know and going out and sort of exploring the world with people that we already know and that we like. And by doing that, we can, in some sense, expand our existing network, but it's built off of the base of our existing network, our friends or our family, whatever. And the idea was at the time, I think neither of us knew how to develop in a sort of any production environment. We didn't know what SQL, what NoSQL, what data modeling was, what the term JSON even meant, what big data even remotely was. But we started off with opening up the Sketch app, and we started out just drawing a bunch of stuff onto this, the artboard in Sketch. And, you know, he graduated at the time. He's a few years older than me, about 5 years older than me. And you know, he had the time to be able to really invest into the design process of it. I, at the time, was in school. And so we started really designing out the application, and we created this sort of wish list of this is the cool stuff that we've seen in other apps, and this is what we'd love to see in our apps. And from there, it was my responsibility to then start developing the entire idea of, okay, how are we actually going to take this idea that we've made in a sort of dumbed down way in Sketch and then go actually develop the technology behind it. So we hired a few people, and I'm again putting hired in these sort of air quotes. We didn't pay them, but none of us were paid, frankly. And we just kind of convinced them to come work for us and with us, and they became part of our family. And yeah, now we're about five people at the moment, and we're all just developing away, and it's super fun.
That's awesome. So do you guys have a revenue model right now, or is it still just trying to get people on the platform and whatnot?
So there's a certain amount of stuff that I obviously can't say, sadly, but I would
right.
Sure that. But right now, I would say that we are within that pre-seed stage.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, I kind of figured. I would say that throwing ads early on into a platform probably isn't a good idea. I think that seems to be the overall, I forget what the... That's why I just introduced my mother to Silicon Valley recently. I don't know if you're a fan. Do you watch
Silicon Valley? I've seen a few episodes here and there.
Okay. There's a, so I started her off at season one. We got through, and there's a venture capitalist on there, and I forget, Russ Hanneman, and he's just this like crazy, like vile, like white dude, kind of like how you like what you think of like an eccentric billionaire kind of. He said, like, what? No, you do not make money right now. You need to lose money. If you make money, then they're going to expect whatever. I forget what the thing is, because they started talking about revenue streams and kind of a mixed bag there, I guess. I mean, obviously it's fiction, but I would imagine there's some truth to it, though.
Oh yeah, definitely. No, I mean, I would say so. One of the big things in the Silicon Valley, and I think just having co-founded a startup in the past, was that for the most part, everyone sees that end sort of Elon Musk-y idea of, wow, like, oh, he's a billionaire, this is awesome, but we just have to start a thing and then we can make a bunch of money. It's so much more complicated than that, taking someone's money, unfortunately. And writing yourself a paycheck is so incredibly difficult. And even going out there and getting money, especially with the idea that you may have to pay it back at some point. And if this all goes under, the expectation is that you quit your full-time job. So, I mean, the romanticized idea of Silicon Valley is definitely there, but there's that huge dark side of it, of there are people that are, you know, quitting their jobs to go chase this dream, and they don't know if it's going to come true. And as I'm saying this, I will probably eventually end up quitting my full-time job to go work with Twine.
Well, hey, man, I mean, what I mean, you gotta do something, right? I mean, if that's the only way to get it past that level, I mean, there's always going to be risk involved in any kind of business. And I think you can only minimize it so much before you can either say, this is it, I've got to devote full time attention to it, or it's never going to get anywhere. And if, I mean, that's not for everybody, of course. So really, if you can do it, then do it. That's what I say.
Yeah, I mean, that's the goal. If we have enough of a reason to go full time, then I think all of us are just going to end up going full time as it is.
So how, I'd imagine that you're writing in Swift. Can you talk about that on the app?
Oh yeah, I mean, which part in particular do you want to know about?
Well, no, I'm not talking about implementation details. I mean, I want to hear about, like, you've been working on this. How long have you been working at the startup?
I would say a year and a half of actual development. Before that, it was just solution finding.
Okay. How has the process gone from being the sole developer, essentially? Because from what I was understanding earlier, is that your co-founder was more on the design business kind of part of it. Is that a safe assumption? And so, and then you did all the initial development. What was it like going from you being the only person touching the code base to bringing in other people and then setting up? I mean, you have to have some kind of process and procedure, whether it's relatively rudimentary or, you know, what have you. How has that been, going from you by yourself to bringing other people in and messing with your code?
I would say so. And this is probably going to sound terrible now, and like anyone from Twine hears this back, but I had no idea what I was doing. I would say with 100% confidence, I was just kind of seeing what I knew how to do and what kind of made sense to me, and I just went with it. So a lot of it was intuition, and I mean, if any economist can tell you, intuition is probably the worst thing that we have. And you know, I did things that kind of implicitly would make sense to me, that, you know, now that I realized were 110% incorrect. And then when I brought someone into that environment, a lot of it was, you know, I had to shut up, and I had to not be the co-founder, and I had to be someone who was still learning how to develop in a production environment. And then also realized that I was still a college student. I still had a lot of learning to do in my CS career, and somehow still manage these people. who were, you know, they were out of college, and I was significantly younger than them. So there was that very awkward sort of, you know, he's younger, doesn't know as much, but for whatever reason, he gets to make decisions. And that dynamic was also really difficult to, I would say, really maneuver through. This, it's a whole new world as far as like, and not only the management curve, but the development curve as well. You know, at the end of the day, our user base might not be exactly where I want it to be, but, you know, for the N number of users that we have, I want to be able to write the best code. So I started doing something, and to anyone that's listening to this podcast, I'd highly recommend never doing this, but I would go and schedule these interviews for iOS development back in my third year. And I knew I would tank them for a fact. I had no idea what I was saying for most of them because I mean, I couldn't, there's no way I could. I've never worked in a production environment and I was still trying to figure it out. But what I would do is I would ask them about their product and I would kind of just listen to them and they would talk about the technologies that they use. And I learned about like GraphQL and just so many more technologies, libraries, SDKs. And I would go into the in-person interview and I would completely tank it, which I was totally fine with. Because I would be able to then take my knowledge and, you know, use it for to just learn more.
That's an interesting method. I don't know that I've ever heard anybody use that method to go back and then apply to their own product. Do you use GraphQL?
I try to, but then realize quickly that Firebase is probably not the best environment to use any sort of API whatsoever, or build an API later.
Okay. Are you using Firebase for your app?
Yeah, well, I mean Firebase amongst other technologies as well. We're sort of coupling a bunch of other stuff.
Okay. Yeah. I had looked at dabbling into GraphQL. It seemed I'm just already super comfortable with your standard REST and JSON type of responses that I don't know when, you know, I've done a little bit of Node. I haven't done a whole lot of Node. I don't really like JavaScript that, you know, all that much. If I have to, I'll write it and I'll, you know, write it as best as I can. But at the end of the day, I'm just not a big fan of the language in general. But then I started looking at, I looked at GraphQL a bit myself. And for anybody that doesn't know, just so we can kind of, GraphQL is a backend technology, and whenever you submit a request to the GraphQL system, I forget exactly how it works. It's not a server, but whenever you send a response, you're just asking for whatever information you want. So if you have a model object that's, you know, say you've got a book object on the server that you want to get, and you only want the author and the publication date, that's all you'll get back. You don't make a request for a book and then get back like the author, the publishing company, however many editions it has, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You just get back the information you want. So, is that about as correct as you remember? I haven't looked at it.
I mean, I would just say, to even put it a little bit more simpler than that, just because, I mean, learning Swift podcast. And, you know, I even back when I was learning Swift, I had no idea what an API was. But it's just basically another language for your backend service to communicate with your client, your app. That is the simplest way I can put it.
We're coming up on the end of the show. Is there anything you want to talk about before we sign off?
No, I think I'm pretty much good. But just to retrace back to the tutorial part again, tutorials are super necessary, not trying to hate on them whatsoever. But creativity is also super important.
Yeah. I mean, and nobody sponsors this show, nobody pays me to say anything, but I mean, if tutorials, you definitely want to check out Ray Winderlich, Paul Hudson, and then the guys from Objective-C.io. I've recently started looking at their stuff for more advanced Swift knowledge, and I've definitely been learning a lot from their information. They're not very, you're not getting a lot of code along type of stuff with them. It's more like something you might want to try out in a playground after you read about it. But there's a lot of good information there. But I would definitely suggest wholeheartedly at least those three resources. And there, I'm sure there's some other great ones out there too. Those are the ones that I've personally used and will recommend. And those are the only ones I currently will recommend that I've used at this point in time. Do you have any recommendations for tutorials?
Yeah, I would say so. Sean Allen, definitely. He's a great YouTuber. More on the, I would focus more on the career side for him, and sort of just learning the changes in the Swift language, and like maybe just small little bite sized videos. But for a proper end to end tutorial, like the ones that I would actually recommend would be Let's Build That App. He goes through, I can't remember his name, but he goes through building out, let's say the YouTube app or the Twitter app, and then connects their functionalities and sort of takes a deep dive into technologies, which is something I can appreciate.
Brian Voong, I think is how you pronounce his name. Yeah. I've seen a handful of his videos, especially when I was trying to figure, like up until almost a year into learning, I never really learned how to do UI in code. And he is, I don't think it's absolutely 100% necessary that you have to know that, but I do think it's useful in some situations, where storyboards can kind of get messy with IB outlets and stuff like that. I don't believe in adding pan gesture recognizers to your storyboard. That's just a personal opinion, or any kind of gesture recognizers as a storyboard action. Once again, personal opinion, you can do it. But Brian Voong if you're interested in a resource to learn how to do UI completely in code, he is a good resource for that. That is a guy that I would also recommend. But I've been kind of, I don't really do a whole lot of videos at this time. So before we sign off, where can people get a hold of you if they want to reach out to you?
Man, I was expecting this. Either I would say my Instagram account, which is almost a grossly disconnected form of media. I feel terrible for saying it, but that's probably the best way to get to me. Or my email.
Wow. You're not on Twitter, huh?
I'm not. I am. I have a Twitter account, but if you want to get hold of me next year, I would say send me a DM right now. So, I mean, I think, I don't know if I can just mention my email right now. Would that work?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, you can reach me at Instagram. So I believe my handle is, and I have to pull out my phone to check, which is probably not too great. Sid Verma OVO. So that's SIDVERMA OVO. And then you can send me a DM through there. My account is public. And my email address would be sid.verma. So same way you spell the handle, sid.verma014@gmail.com.
Awesome. And everyone, you can reach me on Twitter at Steven with a V underscore 0351 on Twitter. You can, you know, just say hello, or if you want to be on the show, you can reach me there. Also, the show does have a website. That's learnswift.fireside.fm. So if you would like to be a guest on the show, you can go on there and you can find a link to a Google form that I have where you can go fill out to put your name in the hat. And I also want to give shout out to Fireside Swift for holding it down while I've been on break. They've been going strong since Swift Coders and the Learn Swift podcast has been on break. And then Eman has launched the Swiftcraft podcast. He does a monthly show. He is part of the Swift Coders Network as well. He's got, he had three episodes. The last one was with a gentleman named Andrew Bancroft, if I'm not mistaken. They talk about core data. They got some pretty interesting stuff. They actually convinced me to buy the Objective CIO core data book. So that's how you got my sale. Thanks for coming on, Sid.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.